Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Jackson, do I have an official invitation into this discussion group?
Welcome to Cloudlandia. Yes, you do.
You do.
All access pass.
Yes, all access. Yeah. Interesting things. Lots of interesting things.
There's so much. What's on your mind? What's been happening in the last week? Weeks seems like went by fast.
Well, I was able to see you.
Twice.
And it was very interesting. I got to about 10 minutes to 4 on the second day. So this was the free zone. And I suddenly realized I hadn't used any thinking processes during the entire day. I got through 6 hours of workshop just based on questions in the chat. Yeah. And I said, I'm not sure that this is the goal for the future, but it was totally, you know, totally fully participated in right from the opening bell to the final whistle. Yeah. So it's kind of,
That's true.
They were kind of related, the longevity and the intellectual property discussion kind of knitted themselves together. I didn't make any attempt to knit them together, but there were kind of some little connections that were being made in the afternoon.
Yeah. Well, intellectual property, you know, as we're in the migration, the intellectual property is really what's the crown jewel in Cloudlandia. Is really its drives on intellectual property is greater than physical property, kind of thing. I've been thinking about, like, you know, kind of codifying the differences, the distinctions between Cloudlandia and the mainland, right? And there was a property advantage, I guess, on the mainland. Property advantage was having physical property, that was a thing you could expand your wealth and your reach through acquiring physical property. But now, exponentially with intellectual property, you've got room to spread so much quicker in
Cloud Land. If you're good at it.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned this, the ongoing kind of observation here of Mr. Beastburger is the latest from the VCR Chronicles, as we talk about vision, capabilities, and reach, that there's actually, I've learned some more interesting just perspectives about it, that, you know, he opened up 300 locations, virtual locations, in one day, by partnering with independent restaurants with excess capacity to, and he brought his intellectual property of the recipes, his menu, you could call an intellectual property, right? The name of the burger, the recipe for it, menu,
the recipe, the specs.
For it, the specs of this is the bun, this is the quality or blend of meat, this is the cheese, this is the, all those SOPs, basically, right, for making a Mr. Beast burger or making a Mr. Beast, chicken tender sandwich, all that stuff, that anybody in possession of those SOPs can follow that intellectual property using their physical mainland capabilities, and then reach out through the through Grubhub and Seamless. So to put it in perspective, he opened 300 in one day, and In-N-Out Burger, which is a very famous, successful burger chain, has 314 locations, and they've been in business for decades. And so you think this whole, like, this instant, it's almost like the difference between, combustion engines and electric, that you've got, that's why the electric cars are so fast, because you push the accelerator pedal, you instantly have access to all of the power compared to it having to ramp up or ratchet up, you know? There's something to that. I also found out that there's a actual company behind the infrastructure for it called Virtual Dining Concepts. And this guy, Earl, who started the company, has, you know, family 70 years in business. They own restaurant concepts like Buca di Beppo and a lot of these popular restaurants. And he's actually built a business out of creating these opportunities for influencers. So he's done things with other influencers who have, like, Tyga, who's a rapper. He's got a chicken restaurant that is Tyga Bites, that he's got his chicken tenders that is using the same concept. And other celebrities that they've done the same thing with. And it's funny because now I see this as a new model of business opportunity if you're a mainland sort of infrastructure builder, because it's very similar to, that's the food equivalent of what Seed Labs has done as the cosmetics equivalent for Kylie Jenner and other influencers who now have cosmetic lines on that chassis of their capability to make the physical goods.
Yeah, I think that Beast Burger is meaningless unless it has a, Beast Burger as a Cloudlandia innovation is meaningless unless there is actually a mainland. A mainland location. In other words, that it'd be interesting to see what the perfect fit vision is that Beast Burger, the strategic team, as I understand it, he's represented, first of all, as a UTEP. I looked up a little bit about him, but he's represented by a company that provides backstage support.
When we mentioned Knight Media is the company management company,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But as far as fast foods go, hamburger places are the number one component of fast food in the United States. Restaurants that promote themselves as a hamburger place are the 800-pound gorilla in fast food. I mean, you have chicken places, not as much as burgers. You know, you have all sorts of other fast food approaches, but burgers is the American mainstay. You know, the hamburger.
Yeah.
So my sense is backstage, before the day that the click happened, his version of the Big Bang.
Right. That's right. The Big Bang.
When a finger touched a keyboard, that's when it happened.
Okay.
There must have been really extensive screening in a city with 20 hamburger places, why this place would get the Beast Burgers and maybe the others.
I found out a little more about that. That's where this Earl Enterprises comes in. The Virtual Dining Concepts is a company that does just that. And part of what they had access to, like a lot of the restaurants that are serving his things are like Buca di Beppo and Bravo and some of these chains that have excess capacity. So he's their team is an infrastructure builder, I guess, but primarily with their own concepts, but also then going out and finding where they don't have reach.
Well, it's a perfect example of
Free Zone Frontier.
It's actually a three-track Free Zone Frontier in the sense of you have Mr. Beast. He's one collaborator. Knight Media is another collaborator. And Earl is a third collaborator. You're putting three capabilities together into a single collaboration where not one of them has to take care of what the other two are doing.
It's interesting, you know, Tony Robbins has a concept of, and I don't know where he got this, but this is where I heard it from, is the four different, an artist, a manager, a leader, and an entrepreneur are the four business personalities that you need, kind of thing. And everybody kind of presents as one of those primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And they need the others to support. Where people get in trouble, most small businesses are artists. A lot of them are artist driven.
Mm-hmm.
That, and a lot of coaches and physicians and practitioners, people who do the thing, they want to continue to be an artist, the speaker, the writer, all of that stuff. So they make decisions and set goals and stuff based on that. And it was, Tony talked about, thought about it now as a Free Zone. This is back when he was getting started. He was doing events, seminars, which is what he loved as an artist. But promoting them and filling them and doing all of the business side of it was less interesting to him. And he went to a company that was doing big seminars, but they only had, two main programs that they were promoting, kind of thing. And he came to them with the idea of, hey, why don't we, I've got a program that you could promote, give you something else to promote, kind of thing, with your infrastructure, and I'd do a great event, but I need to it would give them some excess some extra things to do, and that worked out well. But about 2 years into it, they came to him and said, they looked at it that there's only so many dollars available for personal development. More people were choosing his events than theirs. So they had to kind of let him go, kind of thing. That was their thinking, which was kind of, funny, but self.
Well, they didn't get the, right? They kind of didn't get the lesson.
No, exactly.
They did. I always say that a lot of people are like a retriever dog, that when the hunter points, the retriever dog licks their finger instead of going and getting the duck. It's an affectionate retriever, but it's not doing what it's supposed to do. Retriever didn't get the lesson that when my hunter points, that's my value as a retriever really depends on me knowing what the pointing finger actually needs. Yeah. To a certain extent, Tony was pointing, and he was the pointing finger, but they said, you know, there's only so many pointing fingers to go around.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. When I went to Western Canada, and I understand, you know, I think I heard a story once that, you know, that Tony did a lot of his very, very early stuff north of the border in Canada. But when I went to Western Canada, there was a conference organizer in Calgary. And he had a speaker, you know, he was good friends with Brian Tracy, because Brian Tracy is from, I think, from Alberta. He was born in Alberta, Brian Tracy. And so he had regular speakers. And, you know, when he found out about us, phoned us and everything, he says, well, look, he says, I got a big contact list. And he said, so can we work out a deal? And we did. And we did. And, but we put it on a time basis that it would be for 2 years. You know, like it would be the first 2 years, which was fine with us, and it worked. And we got a good, you know, we got a good critical mass in Alberta. And then what we used in the other thing that I had for my 15 years of one-on-one coaching, I had very, very high visibility in the life insurance industry. So I could call, go anywhere and get in touch with the people who were in charge of, the agent centered, just not the company centered, but the agent centered, you know, they would have meetings and they would bring in experts. And so, I had a good reputation. I had good word of mouth. And so when we went to London, that's what we did. We had, you know, 30 or 40 fairly influential life insurance agents in the UK. And that they basically created our first year of contacts and meetings. So, you know, the story about how Sears started, you know, Sears was a railroad clerk. He was a railroad. He handled packages coming through a local station, and he got a box of watches that was by mistake. It was by mistake. The watch company sent this watches, and he called, you know, he telegraphed the watch company and said, I got this box. And they said, well, it's not worth it to us. And they may have been onto something. I don't know.
Send a box of watches and see what happens.
Yeah, this is, it's like you're putting for sale signs on somebody else doing it. And then you say, hey, maybe there's something. Why don't you just leave it, you know? And see if nothing else, you'll find out how much your house is worth. You know, if you do this, you don't have to sell. But once you
just leave
the sign on your lawn, yeah. Well, anyway, long story short, Sears just took the watches, and he, you know, went through retail stores in his neighborhood, and he got to the end of the box, and he says, you know, and he charged more than the watch company, because the watch that's available is always more valuable
than
the watch you have to wait a month for. You know, the one you can get right now is always worth, and he realized that.
Yes.
And so he experimented by actually saving up his money and buying another box of watches. And then he would go to nearby towns and everything else. And he says, well, okay, I've learned my lesson. And what he started to do was to buy boxes of watches and send them by mistake to other railroad clerks. That he would send it from his station to another station. And they'd say, hey, this box, you know, this was, there's no place here. And he said, well, here's the thing. It's not worth sending it back. Why don't you try to sell it? And that's how Sears and Roebuck was created. And then he let everybody else in. And you know, in on the secret and on the plan. And he showed them how they would make vastly more money if they actually created a Sears, retail operation than railroad clerk, you know. So I think that it's always entrepreneurism is always seen an underutilized resource.
Yes.
And seeing that there's already an existing market. It's just that this underutilized resource is not being connected to an available market.
Yeah. I think that's it. It's the entrepreneur would be the visionary in our VCR formula there of seeing the all the pieces come together, how all the pieces could work together. You know, I was thinking about Sears Roebuck, and when I was growing up in the 70s, I have a great recollection, and I know these don't exist anymore, but I wish I could remember, there were two sort of rival catalogs that would come, and you would go to the store.
Were you in the States or in Canada?
No, in Canada.
In Canada.
And you would go to the store and you would fill out your order form from the catalog that you wanted. And then they would, you would put in your order and then you would get a notification when the product arrived or whatever.
Yes.
It seemed like they had very limited supply in the actual store. And it wasn't a store you could go in and look at. You go up to the service counter and put in your order. I think it was like, I don't know whether it was ShopRite or Shop. I don't know what the shop something.
In the United States, it was Montgomery Ward. In our town, Montgomery Ward had a order office.
Yeah.
Okay, right in the middle of the town.
Yeah.
You would receive a Montgomery Ward catalog.
Right.
You would Sears catalog.
Yes.
But they didn't have stores. Sears had stores. Well, the truth is, there wasn't a Sears store in our town. It was 10 miles away. Montgomery Ward had these offices in a lot of towns.
That was what I got the sense of. These were all in small towns that you could.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because this was like Georgetown in the 70s.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you know, that's kind of like the internet. You know, now, I mean, it would be, you go online, you order it, except it arrives the next morning.
Yeah.
Everything you can imagine.
What gets eliminated over time is time and effort. You know, I mean, the internet is the elimination of an enormous amount of time and effort. Amazon is a combination of enormous amounts of. So my sense is that humans have two things that are cost to them. The use of time for this rather than something else they'd like to be doing, and effort that they have to put in that is not their favorite effort. You know, so... having someone else, having someone else's time and effort for a negligible cost is a big deal.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, that's something that I think that's why.
Dean, some really smart person had a conversation with me a couple of years ago, and just dropped a line, and I said, "These are the most important three words, my entire future." That's what I said.
That's great. It really is. I mean, and I'm so happy to see I shared the book with someone, in the context of showing somebody that's what we were doing, was being the who for someone, you know? And I think anybody in the business of being a who, it would make so much sense for them to give the book to someone so that they completely understand what that, you know, then when they get it, then they understand the importance of the relationship, you know?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. I have a next door neighbor. It's a couple, and they're great people. And you're always great when it's always a great thing when your neighbors are great people. And she's in the movie business. She's an entrepreneur in the movie business, and her husband is corporate, but he's in charge of perfumes. So in Paris, where he goes frequently, either in person or by Zoom, he's in charge of a huge perfume lab that then privates labels. So they might have 50 different labels of perfume, and they have, you know, they have separate parts of their factory where the different perfumes are made. And he's, kind of overall manager of that the right perfumes get in the right bottles with the right label and they go to the right place and everything like that. But I, just before Christmas, we dropped off a bottle of champagne and a copy of Who Not How. And then we get this really great email from the woman. She says, I can't tell you how much that both, his name is Felix, how much Felix and I, this book, it just is such a great gift. And we've just read it and we've talked about it and everything else. And then about 2 or 3 days later, we came a request that if we bought books for other people, would Dan sign them? So far I've signed 7 books. And she takes it and distributes it. Now some of the people she gave it to are asking if Dan will sign the books. So they're sending her the books and she brings them over. And I've just decided that every book I get, I'm going to uniquely inscribe it. I'm going to give each. So I've signed 8 books so far, and they each have a different take on Who Not How. I got one for today, Athena, and I'm going to send Athena. She's number 8. I'm going to send Athena. But it's really, really interesting. I mean, it's, and I'm just pushing, I'm just going to pursue this next door neighbor thing as far as it goes and see how many books that she, book buyers and book readers, just my next door neighbor introduces to me. And it's worth the effort to me to inscribe each one of them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, very interesting. I mean, it's such a, there's so many implications of it, not even just in business, but in everything. I mean,
yeah,
in life, it's the secret. It really is.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between ancient times and today, Peter Diamandis had a great article. He showed saying that a person whose average income today and lives, let's say in a city like Toronto, and has their home and they go to work and they take part in the activities of the city and everything else, has a slave and equivalent in technology form. In other words, they have in help. So they either have people whose or they have technology whose that are equal to 2,000 slaves for a Roman emperor.
Oh, wow. That's, you look at, I'm excited about a 360, Abundance 360 coming up next week, right? And not this next weekend, I guess, is when it starts.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, what? One of the things that's always interesting to me is to see he's been keeping that graph of, marketing tech, all the software as a service things that are available to support people. And I mean, I got to imagine that this has been a bumper year for that list growing and growing in terms of the number of the landscape of those that are available now?
Well, you know what it is. It's you can take it back to the when mutual funds first started. You know,
yes.
If you think back in the 70s, and there were a few out there. That I think Templeton was out there since the 50s. You know, Templeton uh-huh. had a mutual fund, and he was one of the pioneers. And the whole point, the logic of a mutual fund was, it's too hard for people to know what stocks to invest in. So, you know, if you have a stock portfolio, you would have to, you would have to do the research, you know, and you'd have to be a real student of this on a daily basis if you're going to get involved in the stock market. And the shortcut saving of a mutual fund is that we've got a full-time team that does this all the time. We have vast experience. And we're just going to put together a balanced, you know, and we'll offer three different kinds of mutual funds. One that has risks to it. One that, you know, is balanced between risk and security. And one that's security. And you choose the mutual fund that you want. But, you know, what you pay for, you get. So if it's... you're not going to get a huge breakthrough with a no-risk mutual fund. In other words, you're going to get a steady return. And anyway,
exactly.
So that was fine. And I remember, you know, the 80s was really when, you know, Charles Schwab got in. Charles Schwab came in and a lot of other people came in. And I remember it was cool. You know, it was kind of cool. And I said, this is really... You know, there's really a nice breakthrough. But the, you know, I remember Charles Schwab saying, you know, there's thousands of stocks to pick from. You're going to need some advice on this. Now, that's what Charles Schwab, we're going to give you advice on these stocks. And by the way, we've made it convenient with a mutual fund. You can buy stocks through Charles Schwab, but you can also just buy a mutual fund where we've done the pre-thinking. We've actually... you know, kind of pre-thought it, and it's kind of ready for you, and you don't have to pay, you know, big brokerage fees. But then, you know, within a very short period of time, it went exponential, and now the business of picking a mutual fund was just as complicated as picking an individual stock.
Yeah, because now there's
10 or 15 years ago.
Funds, and
And to this day, you know, I mean, we have sort of money market funds that Babs and I, and it's part of our portfolio, but, you know, the best investment we ever made is in our company. And then the next best investment we ever made was whole life insurance. Whole life insurance, you know, it's cash value life insurance. And the third would be residential real estate, you know.
Yes, yes.
It's done us good. You know, I mean, it's done us good.
Yeah.
Is it spectacular? No. Is it better than probably 95% of other people? Yes.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, that whole, that's a great analogy, actually. I mean, it's a great similarity.
Well, I think it's the same thing with software.
Yeah.
You know, they said, well, you know, software as a service. Yeah. Now there's, it's gone exponential because everybody thinks this is a good business to get into.
Yeah.
And there's 10, 20, 30, I mean, Nick Sonnenberg, he's a consultant to Strategic Coach, and, you know, we tell him what we're working on, and then he has team sources, and then they coach us on the use of the actual service. So, the desire to automate so that you don't have to deal with people, it's only good for a time, and then the technology can get so complicated that you need another person. You need another person in between. So there's this movement between automating and new specialized human service that keeps happening.
Well, and I think that I think that the next evolution of this, what I'm observing, is the opportunity for result as a service. That you know, when you start to think about, because the lines for collaboration are really, you know, they're, especially now that everybody's virtual, the lines for, you know, integrating within an organization or with, you know, collaborators are really non-existent. You know, it's easy to collaborate, but to have someone who's, or somebody offering a, you know, result as a service, that's an interesting.
We have a client who I think is going to be in the free zone really quickly. He's Israeli born, grew up in Israel, moved to the U.S. As a matter of fact, I think he's kind of in your neighborhood. His name is Lior Lieberman. Mm-hmm. And he's been in 10 times, maybe about a year and a half, and he's just gone through the roof. Now, here's the truth. He would have gone through the roof anyway if he hadn't joined Strategic Coach, but he said that his thinking is more unified. He he said, I'm always scaring myself with my own goals and my own ambition, but he said, Strategic Coach allows me to have a more, what he says, positive and relaxing relationship with my own ambition. I said, that's a good way of putting it. But his model, and it's all online, he's a marketer, online marketer, and his deal is strictly, we'll agree on my share of much better results.
Yes.
That's his entire model. And I said, that's great. I said, it's really clean. I said, either party can walk away from it at a certain point, you know, and it's got some conditions. You have to put it in conditions. If they're really doing well and they don't want to, they have to buy them out. You know, which I think is
right.
You know, it's a good, good policy. And if he doesn't do as well, he doesn't get paid. So he's they're
safe. That's right. So he's living in Israel, or he's from Israel?
No. I think he lives near the Orlando area. I think he's near you.
I definitely need to connect with him.
He's marvelous guy. I mean, the moment you see him and the minute you talk to him, to meet him is to like him. He's just got, but he's got a very good brain, you know. He's just you can just see that this guy is really right for what he's doing.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I love stuff like that. Like,
I'll set it up. It'll be a Zoom call or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect.
I'll set it up for you.
Yeah, I'd love that, because that's the kind.
And I don't do that often. You know, I don't waste you and your time on things that I don't think are going to go anywhere.
It's true. Yeah. I'm excited about that, because this is like, this environment right now is absolutely, that's what Cloudlandia is about. That's the opportunity that we have within it, you know?
Got an idea for you.
Let me sit up straight. I'm sitting up straight. I'm in the, because I know there's going to be some.
I want you to sit up straight.
It's coming to me right now.
And I want you to just reflect on the fact whether you made your bed this morning, you know, because that's a morale factor.
Yeah, got that
anyway.
Out of the way.
Okay. That's why duvets are so great.
Yes, it's the truth.
Boom. Instant bed made.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was thinking about concept of normal. Okay. So I'm going to take you back 20 years, and Dean is, Dean Jackson is busily involved one day with things that are, some of them are things he has to repeat because there's part of your business that's in place and you have to make sure that you know, that it's working that day. And then there are new things you're working on,
Yes.
new projects and everything else.
Yes.
And my premise is that on that day, Dean, you felt normal. You felt normal.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Then I'm going to take you 20 years into the future. And on that day, Dean is fully engaged with what he's doing. And there's certain things that he has to tend to that are repetitive. And then there's new things that he's really excited about. But Dean feels normal.
Yes.
And now I'll bring you back to today. And there's certain things that are repetitive. And there are certain things that you're really excited about, new things you're really excited about. But today, Dean feels normal.
Mm-hmm.
So the past thing 20 years ago, the future thing 20 years from now, and today have in common the fact that even though there's a 40-year difference between past and future, 20 years difference between past and future and present, you feel normal.
I do.
Yeah. So my sense is that we're doing the book, The Gap and the Gain, that my sense is that what gets a lot of people in trouble is they think that their ideal for themselves is that they feel super normal. They feel super normal. In other words, there's a normal in the future that's super. It's super,
Oh, and the word that, super and, normal.
And that they also have a feeling that the normal they had in the past was a subnormal. It was a subnormal. And today is just their attempt to get away from the subnormal and get to the supernormal.
That's interesting. Even though,
what do you think about this?
Well, I'm. It's percolating because it's something that I had some kind of familiarity with in a way, because that was the premise of my looking forward to define my perfect life. When I was looking at the things that I realized, that the how will I know when I'm being successful? Because there's a sense of the thing that you're saying, I feel normal, is a present tense experience.
Yeah.
You're describing present Dean feeling normal, right?
Yes.
And this yearning, that's what you could describe, I guess, yearning for super normal is this sense of in the future at some point when I get all these things, I'm going to feel super normal. They wouldn't know those words, though. But I mean that you're going to sense that you're going to feel better, I guess, right? This thing that we're aspirationally seeking.
Yeah.
And so when I look at it, that was my thing, that what I realized then was I really like waking up with time freedom. Like I realized I really enjoy days where I have freedom to do what I would like to do. So that was an interesting, and I see now that the freedom of, there is some freedom in structure that's given me some freedom, right? In terms of, I know that what I do like to do is, and you and I had a great conversation about that, that launched this sort of new model for me, was the Breakthrough Blueprint event. I knew that those days, I enjoy that. But then even to this day, I still, I don't prefer as much structure as what I think you enjoy. Like you're, and I don't know whether that's something like you, how many workshop days do you have a year?
Well, it's workshop events now because it's the 2 hour ones. It's an event. But in terms of full day workshops, I have 52. Yeah.
52 full day workshops, right?
And then I have, you know, I have other events like podcasts, and then I have, you know, book creation, and, you know, I've got, I've got, you know, I've got some very fixed structured on the calendar. So, you know, we're just putting to bed one of our quarterly books, Monday and Tuesday, and then immediately, you know, the process starts for the next book. So, but that just continues on, and, you know, we're a quarter of the way through 100 books. So, the one that goes to press is number 25, and we've done it in 25 quarters, which was my
goal.
Isn't
that, like, I just want to say, you know, that has been an amazing thing to observe. I feel like I remember the conversation that started it. I was happy. I mean, lucky, you know, we started the first two or three we did as 90-minute books, right?
I wouldn't have even started it if you didn't have that capability because, you know, I have, you know, books from the past where I've created books, and that was just an incredibly lonely, painful experience. And you created the 90-book, the 90-minute book process. And I said, well, that's how I'm, you know, I'm just going to put together Impact Builder, and I'm going to send it to your editor, your the person who did it. Yeah. And it was huge. Yeah. I mean, we got it back, and, you know, we had captured the structure. We had, you know, we had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and everything else. And then I have an editor who really knows my voice, and she said, I'd be happy to pitch in to fine-tune this. Yeah. And that was great. But then when I found out that she was taking on a burden for me because, you know, she wanted this to work, but it was worrying her out because she's a phenomenal editor, but she's not, you know, she's not really a writer in the sense that she would do it. But her brother is. Her brother is a copywriter, and he had just finished a big, big contract, and she said, can we bring him in? And I said, of course. And he's terrific. So the last five books haven't changed a word. When I send it to Carrie and Adam, Carrie's the editor, and Adam's the writer, I get back, I read it. I said, I'm not going to change a word. They've really captured the essence of what I want communicated here. Even though, you know, some of it surprises me. I said, wow, it's amazing what he did with that paragraph. So I said, But I said, it's good. It's good.
Yeah.
I said, it gets it across. And their confidence grows. They're faster and everything like that. And, so it's really, really good. But, these things are normal. These things are normal processes for me. You know, it's, And yeah, but I'm just getting around this word normal that I think one thing that humans have at the top of their capabilities to take anything new and normalize it.
Yes. And that's, I like that. I mean, that's, you know, there's, so what, how do we, what is, what, where does that go then? So knowing that
I'll tell you what triggered my thought. Yeah. I have a new 10 times entrepreneur who I found out just with some you know, side conversations and breakout groups that he had been in the special forces. You know, he was Delta, which is the special forces component of the Army, very, very high level special forces, in that he had been an advisor in the Middle East to the country that they were in, to the special forces. So he was a special force advisor to another country's special forces, and that he had done it for about 8-9 years, and that he had been in person on 125 raids where there was violence, there was killing, there, you know, there was, you know, a lot of scary things that happened. And I said to him, first one must have really been, you know, kind of weird. But I said, how long, if you go through 125, at what number raid did it seem normal to you? And he said, it's a good question. He said, there are different things happen. So he says, probably 15 out of 125. He says, from 15 onward, he says, it was pretty normal. He said, you knew 80 to 90% of how it was going to happen, what was going to happen, everything else. So I said to him, so what was the scariest? And he told me a few situations. And I said, okay. Then, after roughly 20 years in the military, in a highly structured, mission-oriented, assignments, what was coming into the civilian world? He said, oh, no, he says, the scare of coming into the civilian world is much greater than anything I ever experienced in the military.
That's interesting. I was thinking about the four C's. It seems like there's some of that too.
Mm-hmm. And he said, "What am I guaranteed in the mission? What am I guaranteed in the military that I'm not guaranteed in civilian life?" He says, first of all, a clearly defined mission. He says, it's given to me. He said, a highly trained team around me where everybody knows what to do right from the beginning. And that's given to me. And he says, a sense of absolute assurance that you can depend on everybody else in your unit. That's guaranteed to me. He said, you get in the civilian world, you got to make up the mission. You got to make up the team. And then you're not sure if they're all dependable. He says, I have to tell you, that's terrifying. So
that's amazing. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just an interesting fact to me that the thing that you would think someone else doing would be the scariest thing in the world, for them it's normal, but them looking at you, what you do and consider normal, is the scariest thing in the world. So it's an interesting contrast.
I was thinking about that same thing with NFL players. That, you know, you just said that same thing. They're so highly, you know, it's very similar. One unified mission, let's win the Super Bowl. And they're a team of the very best specialists in each element that you can get. And then absolute assurance that everybody's on the, you know, you can depend on everybody because they're all like your Cleveland Browns.
Well, it's very interesting. I've read about like Brady or, you know, the really amazing, I mean, great, I mean, hands down greatest quarterback in terms of results that ever existed. You know, I mean, he's just, and he's doing it at age 43.
Yeah.
And
a little historic day today.
Today
is a historic day.
10 years after most. 10 years after most quarterbacks are kind of crippled, you know, he's, you know, and they asked him once, you know, what it's like to have all these 300-pound muscle-bound people rushing at you. And he said, he said, to tell you the truth, they're just shapes. He said, they're just shapes. He said, And he said, the only thing I'm concentrated on is where my receivers are going to be.
Yes.
He said, that's the only thing. And he says, there's two things I'm looking for, you know, on any play, and that if my primary receiver, where he's going to be, then I have to switch the secondary sometimes to the, you know, the third level. But he says, I can't concentrate on what the opposition is doing. He said, there are a bunch of shapes and I try to avoid them, but he said, you know, I can't be focused in that. So that's just normal for him, you know, but we put ourselves in his position and it's terrifying. Well, first of all, we don't even get to the point where we can put ourselves in his position.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. So it's
Well, next time we see each other in person, Dan, I'll run up on you. You can see what it's like to have a big shape running at you. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's kind of funny because my team really, you know, because I debrief after every Zoom workshop and they say, you know, it's amazing how you move around the room. Like, you know, if I have 30 people in front of me who are clients on a Zoom call, I will have talked to every one of them in a 6-hour workshop. Every talk I would have interacted with them about, you know, a dozen of them I've been in breakout sessions with them. And then I have a tremendous memory of what individuals have talked to me about before, because I see their achievements in terms of stories that they've told me. And so I'll go around the room and I say, oh, there. So you remember when we were talking and you told me about this and this and this and everything else? So what is the thinking process you just went through? If you had had that thinking process back then, what difference would it have made?
Yeah.
And the person says, oh, boy, if I had known this 6 months ago or if I'd known this 2 years ago. And then they do a commercial.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's all I'm looking for. I'm just looking for how do I engage this person to help create this workshop? So for me, I've thought it through 50%, but at the 50% line, whether I've spent 6 days on it or I spend 6 months on it, I can't get past the 50% line. And I say, the rest of it's just going to be the conversation. The conversation creates the workshop. And
that's,
I think,
what you're setting is, you know,
breakthrough blueprint is exactly the same.
Exactly right.
I mean, you give them a structure and you put an emphasis on certain things on this day and certain things on that day. But the workshop actually gets created, the breakthrough book put. The customers create the workshop.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's why I love it, because everyone is different. It's never the same.
I love it. Why I love
it. It's normal.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, this has
The other day of having no exercise or structure at all, the questions, I said, yeah, that was really cool. No, they asked me, did you realize that you didn't have, I had just a diagram of the, you know,
I know it's funny at the end of the day, you're saying, let's take a look at this diagram.
This diagram. We got to the end and they said, you know, you didn't have any materials. And I said, you know, that's really cool. You know, so, I mean, I said, it was kind of like, it's the coaching version of Houdini, you know, you know, and I said, you know, but I said, everybody was involved. Everybody was involved the whole day. And, you know, and we had some really cool, because it was about longevity, there was a lot of medical experience, a lot of scientific experience in the room that came to the surface.
Yeah.
It was very interesting because Alan Olson, who's our new guy from San Francisco, you know, he said, I just take this pill every day. you know, and Jeff Gladden, who gives me 70 free pills to take every day. He's like, wait a minute. One pill, you know, so you get this little, yeah, but Jeff, better look into this pill because maybe it eliminates 70 of the ones that you're giving me, you know.
Yeah.
One would be better. In my world, one pill a day is better than 73 pills a day.
That's right.
Yeah. And he says it just starts changing the molecular structure. And, the Navy SEALs are the ones who are really testing this out because they'd like to keep them healthy and keep them for longer. And this pill may do it, you know. And I said, this is really worth knowing. And he's in beta testing, you know, so he's
right.
He's early tester and early.
Yeah.
And I said, what a neat world we live in, you know, and he just came in. I didn't know that, but that was part of his contribution to the workshop. And now everybody's keenly interested. And I said,
I said,
this is really neat. So anyway, I'm going to explore this idea of normal, that we move from normal to normal to normal to normal, even though our achievement and our results and our capability keeps getting bigger. We normalize all that. And normal 20 years ago felt normal. Normal 20 years from now will feel normal, and normal feels. So being happy with normal, I think, is a very, very important skill.
Mm. I like that. I like that a lot. That was...
think your three things that you shared with the group are normalizing mindsets. The three that you shared, you know, regarding time and activity and money that you shared is that these are strategies you use to establish normal.
Yes.
Normal that you're happy with.
Yes, that's exactly right. Daily joy. That's it. And only you're in charge of your meter.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. 100%
objective. That's the great thing about that.
But that's really a topic that the things that you're most passionate, remember, is that it's your passion. And you shouldn't expect that it's somebody else's passion.
Right. That's true. Well, I could talk for days, Dan.
We could, but but this is the hour we get every day, every week.
That's it, every week. That's right.
This is normal.
This is the new normal. That's right. Oh, that's funny. I love it. And we get a record of our conversations, which is fantastic.
Yeah. In other words, that you have willingly accepted a little bit of structure into your life.
That's true. And it's a joy and delight.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. So
I'm not going to push my luck.
So next Sunday we'll be live streaming Abundance 360. So we'll miss.
No,
that.
They don't start till 11 o'clock. Yeah, I guess they do. They start at 11 in our time.
Yeah.
So
that's right. I got the email.
I'm actually a participant in the sense that I'm considered live there, so I'll be in breakout groups and everything. So Babs and I and two of our team members are participants. And looks good. I mean, everything looks good and, you know, looks interesting.
Yeah, I can't wait. I always look forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, he's got that other thing on Thursday, which is an Oculus experience.
I have an Oculus, so do you now, yeah.
Yeah, well, Joe's...
Have you experimented with yours?
No. I have to tell you, just the experience of being in my own brain every day is scary,
is enough.
Exciting, and everything like that.
Right.
sometimes I get vertigo. Sometimes, you know, scary things happened, and I don't need a piece of technology to have that experience.
There we go. Well, we'll see. It'll be normal.
No, I mean, I'll experiment as I go along.
Yeah.
But one of our clients said, oh, it's amazing. I had a balloon ride. And I said, if it was the mainland, I wouldn't do a balloon ride. And
right.
And I went down to 600 feet under the ocean. And I said, if it was the mainland, I wouldn't want to do that. So I said, you better mention something that I want to do before you try to get me hooked on the technology.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
All right, Dan.
Okay.
That's it.
Bye-bye.
I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.